This is a podcast from RTE Radio 1.
Hello, it's the 8th of March and this is The Quantum Leap. In the next half hour, we visit a Dublin that few Dubliners have ever seen. We ask why, historically, there were so few women scientists. And in our weekly look at the natural world, we turn our attention to what's happening at sea. But we begin with the ongoing puzzle of water on Mars. And the Red Planet is back in the news. NASA's robotic rovers have been travelling around the planet for the last couple of years and they've photographed several puzzling formations, including a major one in a region called Meridiani Planum. Now, research published today in the science journal Nature hopes to explain this puzzling formation. Well, to tell me what all this is about, I spoke earlier with scientist Dr. Mary Burke from the Planetary Science Institute in Tucson, Arizona. She's an expert on Martian water herself. And I began by asking her, what is the puzzle that's been bothering Mars scientists?
Well, the puzzle is quite simply this, that the evidence that was found in Meridian in Planum on Mars suggested that there had been water-rich sediment deposited, but the location of those deposits are normally thought to be in closed basins. You need a lake. And when they looked at the topography of these locations, they found that there was no evidence of a closed topographic basin. So they were scratching their heads, trying to work out how on Earth the water would have got to these particular locations on Mars.
So it's how was this formed, is that it?
Yes, how would you end up getting the water to be persistent in this type of location on Mars? Because what you actually have here is a very broad, low-dipping plain that tends to dip towards the northern hemisphere on Mars. And so water will tend to, if it is present, move down that slope away from that location. So you're not getting the environment where these particular sediments should be preserved.
So what does this new research tell us about Mars?
Well, it's quite significant because it completely changes in a way the way we think about how water persisted on the surface of Mars over millions of years. And it's this, the significance of this finding is that the source of the water was not from rain falling on the surface of Mars and standing around in bodies of water such as lakes, but that this water came from the ground, from the crust. It's groundwater from aquifers that travelled at thousands of kilometres away and came up at the surface of Mars crust at this particular location.
Now, this team is based at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, or MIT. What they've actually done, as I understand it, is they've a kind of simulation, so they're not actually digging holes. Is this an unusual way of investigating Mars?
It is, but it's also a significant way because what it's doing is it's bringing our attention to the fact that the hydrological cycle, both on Earth and now apparently on Mars, is a global scale phenomenon. That you can have rain falling on one part of the globe, passing down through the crust, being transported within the crust across vast distances and coming out in a very different location. Now, that's not necessarily happening in a similar way on Earth, but we do have these huge ocean-driven cycles that force precipitation from huge mountain ranges that flow down rivers into the oceans and evaporate off again, form clouds, etc. We've got this cycle. And now what we're finding is that on Mars, a similar cycle, it's a groundwater cycle where precipitation will fall on a huge volcano. It will seep through that rock down into the subsurface, move through that subsurface and peak out at a low point somewhere else in the crust.
Now you're talking in the present tense, but actually, as I understand it, we're talking about a cycle that would have happened millions, even billions of years ago?
Yes, the time frame for all of this is really billions of years ago on Mars. We've had a dramatic change in the climate of Mars since its formation. The ideas, there's a huge discussion going on among the community that studies Mars. One group tends to think that early Mars, as it's known about 3.5 billion years ago, was a very warm and wet planet. It was quite similar to Earth. It had standing lakes. It maybe even had an ocean. In the colder regions, it had large glaciers. And then with time, with the loss of the atmosphere, we had a change of climate to a more arid and then hyper-arid to today's climate, which is absolutely a desiccated, cold and dry planet.
You make Mars sound very, very different to the cold and dry place that it is today. I mean, it's intriguing to think of a planet that would have had rain and possibly even oceans. The puzzling formation that has been at the kind of the core of this new research that's published today in Nature, I understand is similar to formations seen on Earth, where you get lots of microorganisms. So, I mean, the obvious question to ask for Mars is, might there have been life in these standing waters, these ponds and lakes?
Yes, you have to go with the understanding that wherever there's water, and that the water has been standing for a significant period of time, and with significant attributes such as it's not too saline and it is present for a significant period of time, then we're thinking about the ability for microorganisms to reproduce. Now, there's quite a lot of environmental constraints on that in terms of temperature, in terms of how salty that water might be. But certainly, where there is evidence for standing water, there is definitely a chance for life to have existed at some point. Now, whether or not it exists today is something that I don't think a lot of scientists would be prepared to say.
There was water on Mars, by the sounds of it now. We seem to agree quite a lot of it in what you call early Mars, which is over 3.5 billion years ago. What about water on Mars today? What's our current understanding of that picture?
Well, actually, quite significant reservoirs. We've got two polar ice caps that have significant volumes of water contained within them. And then a few years ago, we had a satellite go around the planet collecting data on gamma neutrons. And it was a gamma ray spectrometer. And it picked up significant deposits of water just beneath the top 10 centimeters of soil over extensive areas of the planet. So in the early scientists' research, they found evidence of large channels, catastrophic, what they call outflow channels, which are huge canyons. They found river networks. But it was controversial. And then when this instrument got up and measured these neutrons, it was able to say, well, look, we have a water signature from just below the surface. We have permafrost on Mars.
Intriguing. And Mary, your own work, because I know you study formations on Mars. How do you study Mars from Earth?
Well, we have to... go into similar environments on Earth to try and find landforms that may help us explain what we're seeing on Mars. And this is why, personally, I'm very excited about this finding in this Nature paper that's been released today, because what it's saying is that we need to shift our thinking about Mars a little bit and try and focus on the understanding that groundwater is a very important source. Now, this has been recognized before, but not to such an extent. And I do some work down in South Australia on a site known as Dalhousie Mound Springs, which is a location in the Great Artesian Basin of Australia, which supplies the majority of Australia with its groundwater resources. And we find that in a certain location, and it's a location where there's a fault, a crack in the surface, an anticline, we have seepage of that Great Artesian water, water that's fallen in northern Queensland that's taken 400,000 or 500,000 years to move through that aquifer to come down to this part of South Australia, comes back out in these beautiful hot springs that are like small oases in the desert. And when that water comes out, it precipitates these carbonate salts on the surface, forming these mounds and forms these very sinuous channels that life just in the desert is drawn to and grows there. And it's these similar deposits, not necessarily in terms of their chemistry, but certainly in terms of their formative mechanism, that we're now finding on Mars.
So oases on Mars, is that what we're suggesting now?
Well, the concept of an oasis surely brings to mind vegetation, and I'm certainly not suggesting that we had palm trees growing on Mars. However, we are talking about a significantly wide part of the planet that did have water added at some point. And that's not what this particular paper is talking about. We discover this with the rovers. What this paper is trying to do is explain to us how the water arrived there when there was nothing to trap it in, no barrier to keep it standing there.
And that was Dr. Mary Burke from the Planetary Science Institute in Tucson in Arizona. You're listening to The Quantum Leap with me, Mary Mulvihill. Still to come, historic women scientists. But first, we visited Dublin that few Dubliners have ever seen.
Welcome to Virtual Dublin, and here we are standing at the corner of Suffolk Street and Grafton Street.
Professor Carol O'Sullivan of the Graphics Research Group here in Trinity College in Dublin. This is amazing. What am I looking at?
Well, you're looking at a virtual model of Dublin. We're standing here looking up Grafton Street, and we can move around and turn around and walk up Suffolk Street. And the city is inhabited by virtual humans who are walking around, looking around on the pavements and crossing the roads, and they're wearing realistic clothes that deform as they move, and we're able to move through this interactively as if it was a computer game or a virtual environment.
And it's incredibly realistic. How have you generated this? Because what I'm looking at is a big computer screen. But the buildings in particular look very real to me. The people I can see, while they're very realistic, I can appreciate they're computer generated. Mm-hmm. What is the buildings?
So the buildings have been modelled by hand in 3D modelling packages by undergraduate students in the computer science department. They worked for the past 3 years, or 3 to 5 years, every summer. They worked in our lab using 3D modelling packages. So, for example, here with this church here that was modelled, so they would actually go out and take photographs of the church, and then they would model a likeness of it in 3D in 3D Studio Max, and then they would paste on all the images virtually, so that it actually, the reason it looks so realistic is because it's created from photographs of the real thing.
Because I can see cut stonework, I can see gorgeous carved details on some of the other buildings, brickwork there on the pub facade.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What we do is, so sometimes the great thing about 3D computer graphics is you can create a very detailed model by pasting images and photographs, but some of the details, for example, the clock here on O'Neill's Pub, that's actually modelled in 3D so that it sticks out, so that as you're moving down the street, you get a real feeling that this is actually something 3D.
And despite the fact that we're looking at it on a flat screen here.
Exactly, yes.
Very effective.
So you can also get a very realistic view of the city by using stereo projection. So we have, for example, a screen here, and when we project this onto the back of that screen, you can put special theme park glasses on, and in which it actually really looks like it's coming out at you in 3D on the screen.
Whoa. Mm. How big is your virtual Dublin? Where does it stretch from? And can you give me a bird's eye fly over the roof space here?
Sure. So we have modelled about 5 kilometres squared of the city, from the north side over on up to the top of O'Connell Street, and on the south side right over to, so you can see over there in the distance, you've got Liberty Hall, and we've got the Ulster Bank, we have the IFSC over there down the Liffey, we've got the Spire up O'Connell Street, over to the left we've modelled down the Liffey, right down to the civic offices and Wood Quay and the forecourts.
The forecourts, I recognise that.
In the distance.
And we are slowly soaring now on the screen. And I don't know if people can hear that kind of gentle tapping, rubbing noise in the background. That's you using your mouse to take
us
up and over.
Exactly. So what you can basically do is you can set yourself at any viewpoint and look at the city from any viewpoint. So here, for example, we can see Stephen's Green in the distance. We've got all of Trinity. Trinity is where we started modelling, of course.
Okay,
and actually the centre of virtual Dublin is centred upon the Campanile in Trinity College.
That's the bell tower
in Front Square.
How long did it take to build?
So it took approximately 5 years, starting with the summer work of the students in the first year. We started off with a very simple model of Trinity, and then we built it up over 5 years. And there have been 3 PhD students who have contributed to the system as you see it now. So there was a student who worked on the urban simulation, that was John Hamill, and then Simon Dobbin worked on putting the crowds into it. And then Rachel McDonald here in the lab, she put realistically deforming clothing onto the characters.
So it looks like real fabric as they move.
Exactly, which is something that before crowds in real-time games or environments like this would have very tightly skinned clothing that didn't look very natural.
It's lovely to watch. I can see a huge amount of work must have gone into it. But the big question I'm sure a lot of people are asking, and I am, is why do this?
Urban simulation is a very important area for scenarios like in planning applications or emergency simulations. So a virtual city can be used to do all sorts of what-if analysis on if you want to create a new part of the city, you can place it into an existing city. And in many, many places, an actual real-life scaled model of the city is actually built, which takes, of course, an awful lot of room, and also a lot of handiwork to keep it updated. Whereas with a virtual city, it's a resource that you can keep on contributing to and building, and it's very easy to try completely different scenarios and blow buildings up and see what happens as well.
Have you begun any of those kind of studies yet, or that's something that will now start to happen?
Oh, that's something that we hope will be an offshoot of what our city research is. I mean, our main research now that has been funded for continuation by Science Foundation Ireland is to build the technology that allows for extremely realistic urban simulation.
One of the things I can't help noticing is there's no traffic and it's very quiet.
So again, that's why we have received this grant from Science Foundation, is to make the city more multisensory, so that not only will you be able to see the crowds, you'll be able to hear them, and also we have to put traffic into the simulation as well. So we're going to be working with Henry Rice in mechanical engineering, who's an expert in sound engineering and in traffic simulation, in order to put the traffic in and to make the sounds more realistic.
Can people visit Virtual Dublin?
Virtual Dublin has been used for many outreach activities, for example, on college open days. And we're also talking to the City Council and using it as a resource for the public to be able to see Virtual Dublin, but also maybe to explore new planning scenarios as well.
And one of the uses I've heard talk about for something like this is with kids with disability who may not be able to travel and visit Dublin. Is that a possible application?
Oh, yes, absolutely. This is one of our most exciting outreach activities, is with the Central Remedial Clinic, where we're going to work with some kids who have spina bifida at varying levels of disability in order to develop a game with them that would be an educational game in which they can navigate the city, drive different vehicles, and give them the kind of freedom to move around the city that they mightn't otherwise have.
That was Professor Carol O'Sullivan from the Graphics Research Centre at Trinity College Dublin. And we're going to put a link to their website where you'll be able to get a glimpse of their Virtual Dublin. Just follow the links from the RTE Radio 1 website at rte.ie. Now, from the futuristic world of virtual cities to the realm of history and some historic women scientists. Ask people to name a woman scientist and most people will probably remember Marie Curie. But joining me on the line to name a few more and to discuss why there have been relatively few women scientists down through the centuries is historian of science Dr. Aileen Fife from NUI Galway. Aileen, that first challenge for you, can you name us some more historic women scientists?
I think I can manage that, Mary. I mean, in the 20th century, you've obviously got people like Dorothy Hodgkin and Rosalind Franklin. I mean, I thought Rosalind Franklin would be the other one that people might be able to name because of her work with the double helix.
Good point.
But when you go further back, we've got people like Ada Lovelace is quite well known now for her pioneering contribution to computer programming. We've got Mary Somerville in the history of mathematical physics. We've got Émilie du Châtelet, who was Voltaire's mistress and quite important in translating Newton's works into French and doing some interesting work on, well, Newtonian physics and also chemistry on her own behalf. And there's also a whole host of other 19th century women who are probably less well known today, but were very well known in their day for writing about the sciences, particularly for popular audiences. Oh. But not all of them. Some of them at a higher level.
Okay, well, we'll come back to the 19th century in a minute. Mm. I mean, for my own sins, about 10 years ago, I edited a collection of biographies of Irish women scientists and pioneers. And my impression from that is traditionally women, if they did any science, they did botany. How true is that?
It is fairly true. I mean, there are exceptions, because some of the ones I just named, like Ada Lovelace, Mary Somerville, Émilie du Châtelet, they're actually doing fairly advanced mathematics. But that is quite unusual. Many of the women that we know about were in botany, occasionally in other areas of natural history. I mean, there are exceptions. Caroline Herschel in astronomy, helping her brother discover the planet Uranus. But botany did seem to be something that was quite attractive to women, but also was deemed as being very suitable for women. You know, it's like interest in flowers, it's going out into the fresh air, it's seen as being a feminine thing, so it's quite appropriate for women to study.
And quite acceptable. Now, the 19th century, I know, is your area of speciality, and that's a century when we see real professionalisation in science. We see college degrees, institutions and organisations. What are women doing in the 19th century when it comes to science?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's one of the fascinating things, because you'd imagine that the closer we get to our own time, you'd expect there to be more opportunities for women to be involved in the sciences. And actually, you can argue that the 19th century is the period when women's opportunities actually get restricted more than they had been. If you look at the 18th century, if you were of the right social class, you had to be quite aristocratic, you might be able to be involved in the sciences even if you were a woman. But by the 19th century, that becomes much, much more difficult, because unless you have the right expert training, the right university degree by the end of the century, then it's very difficult to be involved in the sciences by the end of the century.
So women who are interested in science in the 19th century, what access have they got?
Well, the same as, of course, many men who are interested in the sciences but who are not themselves scientists. There is a wide range of public lectures, increasingly so as the century wears on. There are natural history museums, there are zoos, there are botanic gardens. There's an enormous range of published material from magazines such as, well, the Gardener's Chronicle or the Natural History magazine, down to Popular Science Review at the end of the century. Women would read those, as would men. I mean, they're not just for women, but there's this... an enormous range of things that you could get access to if you wanted to learn about the sciences. But this is, of course, all informal learning. It's not, you know, formal school or university education.
Or the learning that gives you access to the kind of the priesthood of science. Are women writing science?
Yes, definitely. But most of them are writing for that popular audience rather than for specialists. Mary Somerville is a very unusual exception, who did write books that were very well regarded by her male colleagues, and there are a few other exceptions. Margaret Gatti is one who wrote a very important book on seaweeds that was very well regarded by the scientific community as well as by the popular community.
And I can think of Agnes Clark from Skibbereen, who also wrote for the astronomical community and was well thought of in her day, and a crater on the moon named after her.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
There are women doing science, but so few of them. I mean, is it that the institutions actually deliberately exclude them?
Yes, but it's interesting that until it gets tested, you wouldn't necessarily realise that they were being deliberately excluded. So that it's not really until we get to, let's say, the 1870s or 1880s, when women are trying to, say, get into universities, get admitted to the general medical register, things like that, that you then discover that, yes, actually, they're not going to be allowed to do this. I mean, if you look at when women start to get degrees from universities and when they do start to get admitted to the professional societies, it's the very end of the 19th century. Partly... women, not that many women had tried before, but once they start trying, you then got all sorts of motions in the society saying, well, you know, are we going to admit women? Are we going to allow this? And usually saying no until at least 1880, and in some cases much later. You know, think Royal Society. When did they first admit women to be full fellows? I think it was the 1940s, wasn't it?
I think it was. In fact, 1947 is something of a landmark year, I think, for admitting women to various institutions. Your own background, I know, is biochemistry. Do you have a heroine?
I do, but it's nothing to do with biochemistry. I mean, I quite like Mary Somerville as a figure, actually, but because she's one of these more aristocratic ladies who had quite a lot of opportunities, I'm not going to choose her as my heroine. I'm going to choose the seaweed lady, Margaret Gatti, because she's really quite an amazing figure when you think about what she managed to achieve. She was the daughter of a clergyman, she married a clergyman, she had 10 children, and as well as doing all of that in a parish outside Sheffield, she managed to become this rather well-known expert on seaweeds. She seems to spend every summer down at the coast, digging around in the rock pools, looking at seaweeds. She has got two species named after her. She became a correspondent of William Henry Harvey at Trinity College Dublin, who was one of the world experts on seaweed, and of various other scientists. And she was also really important in inspiring other women to get involved in natural history. She had quite a wide correspondence network, and she seems to have been very generous with her time and her suggestions, sending specimens to other women to help them get started. So she's, you know, this fascinating figure for managing to achieve all of that despite
the
family.
And remembering Margaret Gatti, a name to put up there alongside Marie Curie, Dr. Aileen Fife. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Now, time for our weekly look at the natural world, and this week we're turning the spotlight on what's happening at sea. Well, on the line from Dunleary is oceanographer Charlotte O'Kelly. Her company, TechWorks Marine, sells monitoring devices that allow fish farmers and local authorities to keep an eye on water and environmental conditions. So, Charlotte, more than anyone else in Ireland, you must know what's happening at sea these days. And now that spring has arrived, is the sea starting to warm up?
The sea is starting to warm up. We must always bear in mind that there's about a 3-month lead time between our atmospheric warming and the oceanic warming up. But just to give you an example, at the moment on the West Coast, it's about just over 8 degrees centigrade, which is relatively warm compared to this time last year, where it was about 7. So not only are we seeing a slight seasonal warming up, but we're also seeing a slight warming trend in general.
And is that because we had a very warm summer and a very mild winter?
We've had two warm summers back to back, and the prediction is for the warmest summer on record this year. So that does have an effect on things. And as you say, the mild winter has also generated that.
So are we seeing warm water species sooner than we'd expected, for instance?
I would say yes. For example, my colleagues in the fish farming industry are saying that they're still seeing cetaceans as far up as Loch Fyne in Scotland at this time of the year.
And by that, do you mean dolphins?
Dolphins, and also they're seeing fish such as mackerel being still quite active over the winter, which is unheard of.
Gosh. Now, it's also been a rough winter. Has that been a problem for fish farmers?
It's been a bit of a problem across the board. Some of our equipment's been submerged by 2 to 3 metre waves at times this winter. But on the whole, I don't think there's been huge losses due to the bad weather. Where the weather has been of interest has been to do with maybe the tides. We had some of the lowest tides on record in the last quarter of last year. And this year in January, on the 22nd of January, we had our lowest tide that we've ever recorded in Dunleary, which was due to a low tide as well as a high pressure coming over very quickly. So the high pressure basically pushed the water even further down than it should be on the low, and it actually hit char datum, which is what we measure low and high water from.
And what does that mean? Did it reveal the sea bottom that has never been seen before?
Some parts of Dunleary Harbour were seen for the first time by some people, yes.
Excellent. Okay, Charlotte O'Kelly, thank you very much for that. That's it for this week. Now, the sharp-eared among you may have noticed it was an all-woman edition of The Quantum Leap because we've been marking International Women's Day today. As always, you'll find more information about the items in this week's programme on our website at rte.ie/radio1/quantum. And if you want to contact us, drop us an email to quantum@rte.ie or write to us. We're always keen to get postcards. Quantum Leap, RTE Radio, Donnybrook, Dublin 4. But for me, Mary Mulvihill, until next week, Sloan Thomas.
You've been listening to a podcast from RTE Radio. For more details of our podcasts, visit rte.ie.